Okay, so I wanted to get us through exam one before I brought up the whole presentation idea. At the end of the term, we have several class periods dedicated to where you can teach something to the class. And what I am going to hand out now is a list of presentation topics, okay? I want you to look at these. If you're excited by several of them, great. If you have some burning desire to do something else, you're welcome to email me by the end of Monday, and then I will take those topics, if they're reasonable, add them to the list and give them to you as choices. So the way this will work is you will take the list and look through it and basically pick five things that you would be willing to do and give them to me in order. The sheet that I hand out next Tuesday, I want you to hand back with those ordered. And then what I'll do is form groups around topic preferences. And then within the group, what I'd like you to do is get together, learn about the topic, and basically prepare to give a 20-minute lesson on that topic to the group and to the class. And you, as members of the class, will each basically evaluate the presentations, okay? And you will evaluate the contribution of members of your group. And that's sort of how it will work. So what I'll ask you to do is to rank each presentation on some scale in terms of certain criteria that I give you. So basically clarity, interest, entertainment, all the various things that might be relevant, the physics. The topics have to have something to do with stuff we're doing this term, and you'll see that ones I've chosen do, but you're welcome to suggest some that come to your mind. In terms of groups, I basically want to give each group an opportunity to let me know if somebody didn't show up or contribute at all, in which case I'll actually will gig their grade on the presentation. I won't make any adjustments in grade unless I get basically a reasonable consensus from the other members of the group. So if you are part of a group and you never show up to any of the meetings, the rest of the group will say, well, they weren't a member, and then I lower your grade and everything. But if you just get pissed off at somebody and you say, oh, this person didn't do anything, if it's just one of you, I'm not going to do anything. So the only way to really screw members of your group is to get together with three or four other members of your group. And just kidding. You don't want to actually do that. So any questions? So we'll talk more about the evaluation and stuff. Yeah.
Can we apply as a group to a topic?
I will give you a chance to give me other constraints. So if there are other people that you want to work with, fine. And we'll try my best to satisfy everybody's desires, give them a topic group that is of most interest to them, and if you express a preference to work with someone, I will try to get you there. Having said that, when I get down to the end of trying to get everything sorted out, sometimes I don't quite get everybody's top preferences, and sometimes, you know, sometimes this person wants to work with that person, this person wants to work with that person, and it just, you know, it becomes sort of ridiculous. But I will try. Anything else? Yes?
When in the semester are the...
It'll be the last several classes. Anything else? All right, and once we get the groups formed, I'll then be asking you to give me your preference as to which day you'd want to present. So we'll try to settle that and try to make that work around. You do not have to be present in the presentation if you're a member of the group to get full contributing credit. But if you know you won't be here that day, make sure you're doing other stuff for the group. Don't have your contribution be to make the presentation and then you're not here. That doesn't work well. Okay? And we'll talk a bit as we get a little bit closer. Part of doing the presentations is to deal with technical issues. So you got to test run stuff. If you come in with a Mac, it won't connect. Right? If you don't have the little doohickey that connects, it doesn't talk well to the rest of the world. You may love Macs and think there's nothing else in the world, but it will not talk to the AV here. So you've got to make sure these things work. If you make a presentation out on a Mac and you then try to put it on this PC, the chances of your videos not working or your graphics not working is very high. So you have to test run everything. If you expect the audio to work here, you better test run the machine that you're expecting to run here, right? Otherwise, you're going to be sitting there and your whole time will go toward debugging whatever it is. Okay? So, I don't know if it's coming off this way right now, but it's actually meant to be fun. The whole idea here is for you, I mean, I have a list, a laundry list of topics that I basically have to cover for this class. And so we sort of do the standard thing of probably doing too much in a semester, and I try to do these things. There's a lot more to physics. I know most of you are doing this class in part because you have interests in things. And so this is an opportunity for you to actually pursue some other interests and learn how it works and relates to stuff like this, and then to share it with others. The whole presentation thing is an interesting exercise. I mean, on the good side, it gives you a lot of experience. It's very different sitting where you are and standing where I am. And so the idea is to get you to learn something to a bit deeper and convey it to other members of the class in a fairly serious way. I mean, it can be fun, but... So there are lots of good reasons to do it. Group work always has a little downside, but you'll never actually be able to get away from it. And knowing how to sell your stuff, make presentations and things like that, you really can't get away from that. I mean, you might think... In a most academic sense, you might say, okay, well, I'm going to go to graduate school and now I'm going to go hide in my lab and never talk to anybody. It doesn't work that way because you have to get money. I mean, you can't actually avoid it. Even string theorists have to sell their stuff and get money for it, right? So it's not, you're going to have to talk to people and sell your stuff even if you're not a salesman. So this is, again, a little bit of... probably a good experience, I hope. So that's the idea. And so look over the topics, and if you have some other burning thing in your mind that you would love to do, you're welcome to add it to the list. And if enough people are interested in doing that topic, we'll form a group around it. Okay? You might have some idea that nobody else in here has an interest in which case we're not going to form a group around that. But all right? So anything else on this? Okay, so last time we were talking about relativity, and the general problem is we have two reference frames, one of which is moving with respect to the other. And it's moving at a constant velocity. That's actually an important constraint here. And one thing we've seen is you have time dilation. And the trick to remember is that the time is shortest as measured in the proper frame. The proper frame is the frame of reference where the event happens at rest. Okay? So it is the one, if something's happening, it's the one that's moving with that event. And that is, there's only one proper frame per event, and it's the special frame. So this is the rule to remember. And then the times are related simply by a gamma where this is true. So if you have some problem, suppose we have gamma equal 3. When I say gamma is equal to 3, I've just specified what this velocity is, because gamma is just 1 over the square root of 1 minus v over c, quantity squared. And so, you know, Biff happens to be sitting in S prime, and he burps over a period of 2 seconds. If Buffy is sitting in S, and you ask how long would she hear that burp to last, all right, then the proper frame in this particular problem is S prime, because that's where the event is happening. So the time is shortest there. So Buffy will hear a time that lasts longer, and it will last longer by the factor gamma. So it's going to be 6 seconds. Yes?
Is it customary to label the proper frame with the primes?
Even if it was, don't ever rely on that. Okay? No, the prime is completely arbitrary. And you will see it, I mean, I know from my point of view, completely arbitrary. Half the time, I mean, I think what is usual is you'll have some frame S, and then you'll have some frame S prime that's moving with respect to S. But then you go to the problem, and the problem may be written where the proper frame happens to be someone here, and the problem may be written where the proper frame happens to be the other. Or it could be written where it's an entirely different frame, and you have to relate one to this and then that to that to do the problem. So yeah, the reason I'm going through this is to make sure that you understand that not to associate primes with proper or moving or whatever, because that's a completely arbitrary notation. All right? But the one rule that is not arbitrary and will be true on the GRE and in the problems you do is the time is shortest and the proper frame. So if you can figure out what the proper frame is, then you're good. Okay? Similarly, if you have length contraction, so if you want to isolate what's happening in space alone, then again, you have a relationship. You have to put the gamma on one side, so it's exactly the same problem you have with the time. The rule to remember is that the length is the longest as measured in the proper frame. All right. So if we say that S prime is the proper frame, then this is longest, so you have gamma times the thing in the non-proper frame. And sometimes you see this written with the 1 over gamma here. Okay? Any questions about that? Now, these are fairly specific. These are cases where the problem is written in such a way that you don't have both space and time to worry about. Of course, the more general thing is that you have some event happening and you have 2 reference frames, and within each reference frame, you have a position and a time measured. So in the S, you have X, Y, Z, T. In the S prime, you have X prime, Y prime, Z prime, T prime. And the transformation of what one observes in the S frame into what one observes in the S prime frame, that transformation are known, that's known as Lorentz transformations. And what it says is that in the direction which is transverse to the direction of relative motion, there's no length contraction. There's no adjustment in those measurements. But along the direction of motion, this is the formula, and and the time gets changed by this, and again, it has a piece that depends on space. If you let gamma go to 1 because V is small, then you're going to get the Galilean transformations, which is just basic Newtonian physics. If S prime is going the other direction, you end up flipping this sign and that sign. Okay? So this is the general case that you have to use. Oops. I'm missing a page. What happened to it? All right. I'll come back to that. All right, so the other thing we did, we looked at how velocity transforms. So if I have an S and an S prime with S prime moving with respect to the S frame, and I have some arbitrary velocity, something that is moving at some arbitrary velocity u in the S frame, then what does that velocity look like in the S prime frame? And last time we derived these 3 relationships. The x component, that is the component along the direction of relative motion in the prime frame, transforms like so, and it depends on the velocity component in the x in the unprimed frame, as well as the velocity of relative motion. For the transverse dimensions, though, things are actually different because it depends both on the component that you're discussing in the unprimed frame, so why here is feeds into the why there, but it also depends on the X motion. So this transformation's a bit more complex. So things get a little bit nastier if you want to think about how velocities transform. So to just give you a sense of how strange things can get in relativity, although I'll assign some homework problems that will almost certainly do that for you. Imagine if we have an asteroid here. In the S frame, and let's say that we have an S prime frame where the origins coincide at t equals 0, but that won't really look that way in my drawing. But let's pin this S prime frame to some sort of a rocket ship. And let's say that relative to the S frame, the rocket ship is moving at 0.7 times the speed of light. So if we want to calculate gamma, gamma is 1 over the square root of 1 minus 0.7 squared. And that ends up equal to being equal to 1.4. So the gamma factor here is 1.4. And in this problem, what I'd like to do is to say that we have two events. In event one, we're going to say the rocket passes the asteroid. And since the origins coincide at that point, we're going to define at that point t equal to 0 and t prime equal to 0. Event two, we're going to say that a laser flashes pointed toward the asteroid and the rocket ship that basically, you know, don't worry about the fact that the rocket ship at t equals 0 has just crashed into the asteroid, but we're going to assume the rocket ship passes nicely through that asteroid. So a laser flashes and it is pointed toward the rocket ship and the asteroid, and you know, we'll say it's a big broad beam or whatever. And we'll say that it happens in the S frame at x equal to 3 kilometers and t equal to 5 microseconds. So the question is, what does event 2 look like in S prime? Okay? And so now what we have is a Lorentz transformation that involves both space and time. So x2 prime is going to be equal to gamma times x2 minus vt2. So if all I'm doing is asking what is the position where event 2 happens, because I have both the position and time in the S frame. This is the Lorentz transformation that tells me the position in the y in the prime frame. The y and z coordinates just are the same. They just fall out and are irrelevant really for the problem. So this is going to be 1.4. X2 is 3. Ooh. How did I do this? I'll leave it in kilometers, I think. So it's going to be 3 minus 0.7 times 3 times 10 to the 5th kilometers per second times 5 times 10 to the minus 6 microseconds. And when I worked this out, I got 2.73 kilometers. All right, so the person on the spaceship perceives the laser to flash at 2.73 kilometers rather than the 3 kilometers perceived by the person on the asteroid. Maybe that shouldn't come as a huge surprise, because if you think of that 3 kilometers that is seen in S, if you think of it as a big meter stick, right, that's the proper frame and the way you're thinking about it. So that means from the point of view of the spaceship, it better look shorter. So hopefully that makes some sense. Now let's look at the time. That's going to be gamma times T2 minus V over C squared times X2, which is 1.4 times 5 times 10 to the minus 6 seconds minus 0.7 times 3. And I think I have to have the 3 times 10 to the 5th here because there's a factor of C sitting there, which I may have dropped on the slide I'm looking at. At any rate, when I calculated this, I got minus 2.8 microseconds. This is an instance where if you take 5 microseconds and multiply it by the speed of light, you get less than 3 kilometers. So these two events are not causally connected. And the event ordering flipped. The event ordering cannot flip if light could have traveled from one point to the other, because then in principle they could be causally connected. But this is just, if I didn't drop something in the algebra, this is really just to emphasize how bizarre and counterintuitive relativity can be. Remember, because in the Lorentz transformations, the time as measured in the other reference frame depends both on the time and the position, right, of the events. Simultaneity gets changed, right? If you have everything simultaneous in one reference frame from the point of view of this person, it's guaranteed not to be simultaneous in the other reference, in some other reference frame. And only the event ordering is only guaranteed to be the same if light, you know, within the light cone, within the region that light could have traveled between the in the time of that event, or between the two events. So I'm going to assign some relativity problems to you, and I don't know whether to tell you to do a shot of espresso before you do them or a shot of tequila, but you didn't hear it from me, but you're welcome to try each and see which works best. Relativity is definitely strange business, so... All right. But wait, there's more. Okay, so let's suppose that you're flying in a plane. Let's say you fly to LA, and we'll say that your speed is, you know, some big chunk, so relativity is important. What is it? What velocity is actually important to you in terms of knowing whether you're hungry or not when you land in LA? I mean, we may know that this plane is traveling at some large... suppose LA is really much further away, so this is a relevant question, but let's say it's moving at 5/8 the speed of light or something. So on Earth, we look at this plane and it's really humming along, okay? So there is a relevant velocity, which is how far on Earth do you go in how much time on Earth, right? And so that's sort of the standard velocity, would be a dx over a dt, okay? But if you stop and think about it, if you want to know whether you're hungry when you land or not, what's really important is dx over your proper time. Right? Because the proper time is what's important to you and your stomach. It doesn't really matter what's going on Earth. It only matters how much time is passing that you perceive to pass. Right? Okay. So what I want to do is to define something which is known as a proper velocity. And we're going to give it a new symbol, which is this eta, and that's going to be dx, which would be, in this case, measured on the ground, divided by d tau, where this is your proper frame. So this is measured on the plane. So this is a weird sort of hybrid quantity. You okay with that? It also turns out to be a really good thing to define, not only so you know whether you're hungry or not when you land, but it has better transformation properties. The reason this is so ugly, if you recall, is we had this is dx prime over dt prime. Both dx and dt transform with the Lorentz transformation. So the way we derived this is we wrote down dx prime over dt prime and then expanded it in terms of the x and t's. But because the Lorentz transformation is sort of nasty, that gave us crap up here and crap down there, and we ended up with something complex. Okay? So that's why this is nasty. But for the proper time, you have a position in one frame and a proper time in the other. Proper time doesn't transform. It's the proper time, right? I mean, it's simply a measurement of whatever the event is. And there's only one proper time, so the proper time sort of is what it is. Yes?
Should we be able to derive the Lorentz equations? Did we do that?
We did go through it. I don't think I'm going to be perverse enough to ask you to derive them. I mean, I think it is worth your time going through it, so you're a believer. That, I think, is certainly worth doing. And when we derived it, I mean, you may recall, there's some subtleties there, and I think it is worth your time thinking your way through that to make sure you're happy with how that works, because you'll see it again and again and again and again, and relativity is one of those things that it's actually not technically that hard, but it is good to convince yourself that it actually isn't just pulled out of thin air, right? So do spend time with it. I'm not going to ask you to derive those things. Okay, so because proper time is made of one normal quantity like space, and proper velocity is made up of a change in space, which is something that does transform normally, and a proper time, which is a fixed thing, it is what it is in any given event, it doesn't bother transforming. It means that this proper velocity will have the transformation properties of space, which we already know all about. So proper velocity will transform exactly the same way as space does. Okay? So that means that eta in the x goes as dx over d tau, and this is going to transform like x. So this is a much simpler transformation than what we had for a regular velocity. Well, so let's look at this a little bit. We know that d tau is fixed in a given problem, but of course, if it is a time, which means if I know what it is, I know what it looks like in the other frames, and time is shortest, which means it's multiplied by gamma. So we know that dt in some other frame is going to be gamma times d tau. eta, which is equal to dx over dt, is going to be equal to did I get that right? We have time dilation, so the time is shortest. Okay. So that means that d tau, which is in the proper frame of reference, is equal to dt over gamma. So this is going to be gamma times dx over dt, or gamma times v. Okay, so there's a relation, simple relationship between proper velocity and regular velocity. So one of the reasons that we introduce this is because it's relativistically much better behaved. So let us imagine that we have a problem where I have some MA moving at a VA, and it collides with some other mass coming the other way, MB times VB, and going VB. And then, you know, a moment later, we have MC is coming out of the collision with VC, and MD is coming out with VD. So some collision happens in general. You know from Newtonian physics that momentum conservation should hold true. The problem is, if you take this and you try to do momentum conservation putting in a regular velocity, then you will not have momentum conservation working. Okay, it will not transform cleanly. So the way to fix this is actually if you define the momentum equal to the mass times the proper velocity, then it turns out that peak conservation holds. So in fact, what we want to define not only is a well-behaved relativistic velocity, which is the proper velocity, we want to define a relativistic momentum, which is mass times the proper velocity, as opposed to mass times regular velocity. And this then will have reasonable transformation properties and will actually cause momentum conservation to hold in relativistic problems. Yes?
That's right. Just to clear something up, the proper velocity, it's not natural. No one actually experiences that, whether given you're on the ground and you're observing an airplane or you're on an airplane, you're observing yourself.
Well, I mean, you can define it. I mean, if you're on the airplane, so much time passes for you, and the plane moves a certain distance in the other frame. So, I mean, it's a relevant thing. So,
but to you, you're moving longer.
Well, to you, you would actually be moving less long because the distance x is in the proper frame. You have length contraction in the other frame, so you would seem to be moving less far. Proper velocity is a little bit of a weird quantity, so you'll get more used to it, I think, doing problems. But it's a bit of a weird quantity, and the real reason that we have to define it is really right here, because we want momentum conservation to hold in relativistic problems. Now, unfortunately, it doesn't just end there, because what we've done is we've defined this quantity, which we're calling we've got one quantity which we call the proper velocity, but we've also now defined this momentum. So that's really only three things. That's three components of momentum, right? Px, py, pz. And yeah, I'm trying to tell you that it transforms in the same way space does, but remember, if space transforms, it gets all mixed up with this fourth thing called time. So if the transformation is the same, there has to be a fourth something to get mixed up with it. Okay? And so we're going to define the fourth component as gamma mc squared. And this quantity is something which we're going to call relativistic energy. Okay? So what happens is that with that definition, then ma eta a plus mb eta b is equal to mc eta c plus md eta d. And if you want to derive this, okay, if that looks too pulled out of thin air for you, what you can do is to actually set up this equation, all right, with the freedom to figure out what the fourth component of this has to be in order for this equation to hold true, and you'll find that it's this if you use proper velocity here. Okay. So in relativity, very often you run into these little foursomes. So remember we had x and t, where it's x vector and t, and now we've got this eta vector and e. We call these quantities, just like you're used to using little threesomes like x, y, and z for the space vector, or px, py, pz for the momentum vector, now we have these little foursomes, and we're going to call these four vectors. So this is called the space-time four vector. And this is called the energy-momentum four vector. Whatever you want to do in special relativity, you have to figure out how it transforms, and many, many things will transform as these little foursomes. Eventually, I don't think we'll actually get, we won't do that in this class. Eventually, you'll find out that there are sometimes more complicated transformations, so electric and magnetic fields transform in a somewhat more complicated way than just this four vector. So what I'd like to do is to examine for a moment this fourth component of the energy momentum four vector, this gamma mc squared. So the relativistic energy is equal to mc squared over 1 minus v over c squared, the square root of that quantity, which we can rewrite as mc squared times 1 minus v over c quantity squared to the minus 1 half. And this quantity, of course, can be quite small, right? So it's useful to actually see what happens if we Taylor series expand this. So if you want to take that quantity, 1 plus alpha to the minus 1 half, Taylor series expansion is 1 minus 1 half alpha plus 3/8 alpha squared plus higher order terms. Okay, so now if we do this Taylor series expansion of the energy, we get that E is equal to mc squared, so that's the first piece, plus one half times alpha. Alpha is this quantity v over c squared. So this becomes plus mc squared times v over c quantity squared plus higher order terms. And I dropped a half. Okay. So if you look at this, this is E is equal to mc squared plus 1 half mv squared plus higher order terms. Okay? This is what we call the relativistic energy. This is what we call the rest mass, the rest energy. This is, of course, kinetic energy, etc. So if the velocity is zero, what this expansion tells you, once you realize the quantity that you have to use in this transformation is the relativistic energy, if you look at what it is, it's telling you that this relativistic energy has a piece of it which is just tied up in the mass of the object. Okay, and for V equals zero, this is where you get it, E equals MC squared. Okay? And I know you're really used to that and everything, but that's really a profound statement, right? Whoever thought that you could think of energy as just being in the mass of something? But it's just a form of energy. And of course it leads to lots of exciting things like stars working and bombs blowing and, you know, things like that. So there's a lot to be said. Okay. And I would get into that a lot, but this is an E&M course, so I'm going to short-circuit relativity here and reconnect and reconnect with electricity and magnetism. So, but I will say just a little bit more about this. We have had a constraint in what we're doing. All right, so a couple of things. In your next class where you cover relativity, you will probably use these four vectors as opposed to how we're doing it in this class. The four vectors are actually pretty powerful, and they become very convenient for doing these calculations. And the notation is very nice, and so I'm not going to take the week to teach you that in this class because this is an E&M class. But you'll see it, and I promise it's actually very cool stuff. The other thing that we're not going to do much with, but I just wanted to mention, is we have had a constraint throughout what we've been doing with special relativity, which is that the two reference frames are moving at a constant speed with respect to one another. Okay, so it does not involve anything with acceleration. So Einstein, of course, decided he wanted to include acceleration as the next step past special relativity. So what he did was pretty typical for Einstein, which was he sort of took something that we all know and followed it to its logical end and came up with something amazing. So if you get on an elevator, right, and the elevator starts accelerating upward, what do you feel? You feel heavier, right? You feel heavier. If you're on an elevator and it accelerates away from you, you feel lighter, right? So in a duh moment, Einstein says, well, how do you know the difference between an accelerated reference frame and what we perceive as gravity? And he made up a principle he called the equivalence principle, which is that it is not possible to tell the difference between an accelerated reference frame and a reference frame where gravitation is operating. Okay? And I won't speak for him, but at least for me personally, the whole motivation for that is, you know, you get in the elevator and that's what you feel. Right? If you're in a car and you accelerate, what do you feel? You feel thrown back. So it is a way of trying to make sense of these two. But now what are the implications? So let's imagine that you are in a room which has no windows, and we have a laser pointer. And let us consider two cases. Let's actually take a case where this room is now actually on a spaceship, which is way out away from all gravitating bodies, okay? And it is accelerating at 1G, okay, straight up. So here we are, we're in our rocket ship, and it's accelerating 1G straight up. What do you see for something simple? So let's take something simple, such as we take our trusty laser gun and we shoot a pulse of light to the other wall. And instead of having it be a continuous beam, let's assume it's a pulse in this case. And I would like to trace out that pulse from two points of view. One is the point of view of us sitting in the rocket ship, okay? So what happens is we shoot the beam of light, and as the light begins to leave, the rocket ship is accelerating upward. And so we're going to think our way through this. We're going to exaggerate things. Of course, you wouldn't notice this effect in real life, but if you had the ability to see perfect distances and things, as the light moves toward the wall, it takes time because light moves at a finite speed. As that happens, the rocket ship's accelerating upward. So what that means is that if we were to ask, what does that light path look like to us, okay, it would look as if the light were falling toward the floor, sort of on this parabolic path, right? It would actually be curving more and more because the rocket ship is moving faster and faster up as the pulse goes and hits. So we would actually see the pulse of light not hitting exactly on the same height as my arm, but actually somewhat below. So it would look as if it's going in a path like that. Okay? If someone were outside of the rocket ship and able to look in through a window and somehow see the path of this light, what would they see? They would see the light beam going straight and the rocket ship accelerating up around it. Okay? What is Einstein's equivalence principle says? It says that if you're in this rocket ship, we cannot tell whether we're in an accelerated reference frame or if we are in a gravitational field of 1G. Okay? So whether the room is out on the rocket ship or whether it's sitting on the surface of the Earth, in principle, we can't know. So what does that mean? That means that if I take this laser beam and I shoot it like this in a 1G gravitational field, it's going to bend in the same way it would if the rocket ship were accelerating around it. Okay? So there's an example where Einstein's saying, gee, gravitational fields actually have to bend light. And then that has strange implications because light, you like to say it goes in a straight line. It goes the shortest distance between two points. So how do you mathematically model this? Well, one way to mathematically model that is to actually flex the geometry, okay? Instead of living in a Euclidean space, you allow space to actually have curvature. And so the light continues to travel in a straight line, but you say that the gravitational field actually distorts the structure of the space-time. And that's why light travels in a curve. And so that then became a thorny problem because differential geometry of strange spaces like that is a pain. And so general relativity, which is the theory that he developed on this, is a theory of gravity where accelerated reference frames or gravitational fields literally distort the structure of space-time. And that's where relativity comes in. Okay, so you get a lot of weird things out of that, which really isn't part of this course, but I just wanted to mention it. And it turns out that the effects, general relativistic effects, are hard experimentally to find differences between what you would measure for general relativity and what you would measure for Newtonian physics, but there are things that are out there. Typically, if you want to have big effects, you have to have huge masses or large velocities and accelerations and things. However, it does really have its important points. There are some weird things. For example, time moves more slowly in a reference frame that is in a heavy gravitational field, a big gravitational field, relative to one that's not. So if you have a very, very precise clock and you have it here on the surface of the Earth, or you put it way out in space, there will be a relative time shift between these two, which you have to take into account. So this turns out to be these turn out to be critical corrections if you want to make the GPS system work, for example. So the GPS, which may or may not be on your list, I hope it is. If you look at the GPS system, it's literally some satellites, and you effectively are looking at the time of flight of light from these different satellites to figure out where you are. But you have to have the clocks all right to understand that well. And so you have to have general relativistic corrections in this to make the GPS system work with the accuracy it does. So it's not that, it actually has real life applications, everything. Any questions or comments about any of that stuff? Okay. So, what I want to do is to spend a moment looking at something new. So, you've all played with bar magnets, I hope. If you haven't, you should go buy some and play with them. Tell your roomie it's an assignment. So there's a magnetic force between bar magnets, right? But there's more to magnetism than that. Oh, how am I going to do this? There it is. I have a compass needle. That's nothing but a little magnet which is able to rotate cleanly. And if I put it here, it basically will line up in the direction of the local magnetic field, which can get distorted relative to the Earth's magnetic field based on what's going on with the building and things like that. But now what I'd like to do is I have a wire here, okay, that just runs down past this thing. Actually, I'm going to put it up here. And I'm going to put a current through that wire. Watch the compass needle when I do, if I have this thing set up right. Better make sure I've got it set up, get the right one here. Okay, it's this one. Okay, ready? Here goes the current. Now I take the current off. Turn on the current. Turn on the current. You're not impressed? Did you know that currents create magnetic fields? Yeah, you've all known it. Oh, well. I think that's actually pretty cool. I mean, all I've done is I've taken charge and moved it, and all of a sudden out here I get this magnetic field. All right, so there's clearly a very deep and intimate relationship between electric charge or whatever and magnetic fields or magnetism, whatever it is. So if we have a magnet, and this is a very powerful magnet, it has a very powerful magnetic field right in here, and I just have a wire that's hanging limply in there, and I'm going to put a current through that wire. Watch it. Okay. So it does nothing if charge is just sitting there, but the minute I start moving charge through the magnetic field, there's a force that's exerted on it. And the weirdness is, I know maybe in the end we're going to create a picture of forces due to magnetism in the same way we've done with forces in electromagnetism, and we're going to argue that the thing that conveys magnetic force is the magnetic field, just like we've said with the electric field. And in this case, the magnetic field is actually going to run from one of these poles to the other pole. So it's like this. The current is running like that, and the force on this thing is like that. Is that weird or what? See? It's still like that. Amazing. Okay. So fine. Now, let's imagine that I have two wires. There's no force between them. But what will happen if I put a current through these two wires? Okay? Let's suppose I put a current such that it's going like so, okay? I haven't put the current yet. But I have parallel currents going through here. What should happen? I've got a current here, and we've seen that that'll create a magnetism. And then I have a current here, and we've seen that a current carrying wire and magnetism will feel a force, okay? So we should have a magnetic force between these two wires. And in fact, we do when I throw the switch. That's not very dramatic because they're going together. But if I switch the direction of one of the currents, it's a little bit better. Okay, they push apart. So there is a force between these wires, okay? So let's think about this for a minute. I mean, very simply, let's just look at it this way. If I have two charges that are sitting here at rest, there's a force between them. And we call that force the force of electricity, or for electrostatics, right? The electrical force between them. Now let us take these two charges and let's go running past them at a very large speed. We haven't done anything with the charges. Right? It's just now we're going to look at those charges as we run past really fast. When we do that, we will perceive those charges as moving like currents this way, right? And we will perceive the force between them to be magnetic. Now, I still have the net charge here, so I can construct the example in such a way that there's no net charge on the two wires or whatever. But the gist of it is the same, okay? Something that is purely electrostatic from one point of view can become magnetic or partially magnetic from another point of view. And all that's changed is your reference frame. Okay? Einstein's original 1905 paper on the theory of the special theory of relativity was not entitled something like how to warp brains with space-time or, you know, how to make atomic bombs or anything like that. It was called On the Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies. And what he was really probing was this very deep and fundamental relationship between electricity and magnetism, and the fact that we can have a beautiful theory of magnetism or a beautiful theory of electricity or electrostatics, and in fact they get married together in ways that we'll see soon into electromagnetics by Maxwell. But now look at it from different points of view and things go all haywire. So what he did was he made it relativistic, made it work relativistically, and put the deep relationship between electricity and magnetism on a very firm basis. But what it also means, and the transformation is more complex than a straight four-vector transformation or Lorentz transformation, electric and magnetic field components transform when you go from one reference frame to another. And in fact, they get all mixed up. And it's a more complicated thing. It's a tensor. It's like a 9x9 thing instead of a 3x3, which is the Lorentz transformation. So it's more complex. But what you perceive as electric and magnetic fields right here, if you went flying by in a spaceship, you would see it look very different. Okay? So life gets very strange. I mean, there are different ways to concoct this. I do have one example which I can use to sort of make my point a little bit. Suppose we have a conductor, and we imagine this conductor is such that we have free negative charge that is moving this way with a velocity u, and we have positive charge where the charge densities are the same, which is moving this way at speed. How do I want to think about that? Well, I don't even have to do that. I can say that these charges are actually fixed, so we can think of this as a regular wire. And now, if we go running past at some speed v, then what we're going to see, if we're moving very fast this way at speed v, we're going to see the negative charge is moving at a u, some sort of velocity, because we have to do a velocity transformation, and the positive charges will also be moving to the left because we're now running to the right. But that velocity will be different, right, when you do the velocity transformation, because the velocity in the rest frame was different. So up in the top, lambda minus is equal to lambda plus. And on the bottom, remember, what is lambda? It's the number of charges per unit length, and we have length contraction. But because these things are moving at different velocities, the length contraction will be different for the two charges, which means from some other point of view, we're going to have lambda minus not equal to lambda plus. So you'll actually have a net charge, which means you're going to see an electric field, whereas up on top, you don't. In fact, on the top, what you would perceive is just a straight magnetic field with no electric field at all, because the charge densities are the same. Whereas on the bottom, you now may have uneven charge densities, and you'll have an electric field component, even though you started out with just magnetic field components. So these two are very deeply connected. And you okay with that? All right. So I'll let you play with relativity problems. As I say, in this class, it's important. We sort of had to make an excuse to do relativity because it wasn't being done in the 140 series. It does unify. There is a deep relationship between electricity and magnetism that really does require relativity to make it work out and everything. Having said all that, we're now just going to stop with electrostatics. We still will have currents, and we're going to start thinking about magnetism, okay? And we're going to think about magnetism sort of as a separate force for now. In particular, we're going to start out by talking about magnetostatics. Magnetostatics means constant magnetic fields. It does not mean nothing moves in the problem, because that constant magnetic field might be generated by a current, but that current will be a steady current if that happens. And whether you have bar magnets or whether you have a current that creates a magnetic force or whatever, we're going to hypothesize that just like we had an electric field, that there exists a magnetic field. And we're going to give it a symbol, B. And the MKS unit is a Tesla. Okay? And the force of magnetism on objects is described by the Lorentz force law, which actually also includes the electric field. So according to the Lorentz force law, if I have, what we're looking at is the force on a charged particle. Moving with velocity v in region with electric field E, and magnetic field B. The Lorentz force law tells us that it's equal to the charge times E, that you already know about, plus Q, the charge, times V cross B. Right? So this is the cross product. How familiar are you with the cross product? You've been doing that? Okay. Remember with the cross product, and we're going to review this, but if I have a vector A here and a vector B here in this plane, the cross product is another vector where I do the right-hand rule. I put my fingers along A, curl them in the direction of B, and the cross product is a vector that goes off like this. So remember, here, the magnetic field is going this way, the current, say, going that way, and I get a force, like, up at right angles to it. So it turns out as sort of awful, but we get stuck with the cross product when we do magnetism. So magnetism strikes many people as harder than the electrostatics piece, because now everything goes 3D. You just can't avoid it. There's just no way to get around the fact that you basically now have to visualize things in 3D and do the cross product to see what's going on with everything. So just to remind you a little bit about the cross product, because we have to do it. A cross B, it's a vector. The magnitude of A cross B is equal to the magnitude of A times the magnitude of B times the sine of the angle between them. So if they're in the plane of the board, and here's the angle between them, here's A, here's B. So the magnitude is given by the magnitude of A times magnitude of B times sine theta. In the dot product, remember, if I have the dot product between A and B, what I'm doing is I'm projecting out the cosine component, which is, say, for example, the component of A that is along B, right? So it's important in work, for example, the integral of f dot ds. What is important is the force along the direction of movement. So that's what the dot product's about. The cross product projects out the other piece, the orthogonal piece, the piece that's at right angles. So if I have A cross B, I'm projecting out the piece of A that is at right angles to B, and I'm multiplying it times B, okay? Or I'm, the other way to think about it is I'm taking the piece of B that's at right angles to A and multiplying the two together. That's where the sine theta comes in, because if here are the two vectors, here's angle theta. The piece that's at right angles to the other vector is projected out by the sine theta, right? So to calculate A cross B, if you haven't seen it done this way, a way to do it with components is through the determinant. So A cross B is, take I hat, J hat, K hat, if we assume it's a Cartesian problem, put AX, AY, AZ here, BX, BY, BZ here, and you evaluate the determinant. How many of you have not seen it done this way? Has everybody seen it done this way? Wow, it's amazing. Sorry. Well, I'll go ahead and write it out. But so this would be I hat times what you do is you take this I hat and you take it and multiply it by AYBZ minus AZBY. And then you take a minus sign for the next component, J hat. And since you're on the J hat column, you want to do the other columns for the lower two. So it's AXBZ minus AZBX. And then finally, you do the last piece, which is this K times AXBY minus AYBX. All right, so if you haven't gotten good at that before, you'll have to get good at that. But I have to stop now, so we'll come back to this and start playing with magnetism more.